Hey, Mike here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Dark Poutine early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Alrighty, we are back. My name is Michael Brown, and I am coming to you from the Dark Poutine Studio in Langley, British Columbia, and my good friend Matthew Stockton is at his home, the Dark Poutine Satellite Studio in Vancouver, British Columbia. Hello, Matthew.
I think I'll start introducing myself in the future.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm Mike Brown, and this is Matthew Stockton. Welcome to WKRP.
Oh, yeah. I loved Johnny Fever. And Venus Flytrap is cool, too, but Johnny Fever was kind of my...
They're all fun.
He was definitely the person I related to. And later on in life, strangely enough, I did relate to what he did. So
Alec Baldwin wasn't in that show, was he?
Ever? No.
Even as a cameo? No.
No, I don't think so.
See how I brought it in there?
Sure.
The views, information, and opinions expressed during the Dark Poutine podcast are solely those of the producer and do not necessarily represent those of Curious Cast, its affiliate, Global News, nor their parent company, Chorus Entertainment.
Dark Poutine is not for the faint of heart or squeamish. Listener discretion is strongly advised. We're not experts on the topics we present, nor are we journalists. We're two ordinary Canadians chatting about crime and the dark side of history. Let's get to it. Put on your toque, grab yourself a double-double and a Nanaimo bar. It's time to scarf down some Dark Poutine.
You are responsible for obtaining and maintaining at your own cost all equipment needed to listen to Dark Poutine. Dark Poutine can be addictive. Side effects may include, but not be limited to, pausing and questioning the system, elevated heart rate, pondering humanity, odd looks from colleagues as you laugh out loud at work, family members not into true crime worrying about you. Positive side effects may include some perspectives and opinions that you disagree with, as well as some wokeness and empathy. If you don't think Dark Poutine is for you, consult your doctor immediately.
On October 21st, 2021, a tragic accident occurred on the set of the low-budget Old West movie Rust, filmed on a New Mexico ranch. Wife, mother, and cinematographer Helena Hutchins, 42, was fatally shot, and writer-director Joel Souza, 48, was injured. It was the lead actor and producer, Alec Baldwin, who was holding the prop gun that killed Hutchins and wounded Souza. Somehow, it contained a live round. Investigations also revealed other live rounds on set, which is never supposed to happen. Baldwin and the film's inexperienced armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, 24, were eventually charged with involuntary manslaughter in Hutchins' death. Dave Halls, 63, serving as the first assistant director on the film, entered a no-contest plea in accordance with a deal made with prosecutors, accepting responsibility for the misdemeanor offense of negligent use of a deadly weapon. Numerous civil suits have also been filed, with accusations of negligence being leveled against several parties, including the production company, Hannah Gutierrez, and actor Alec Baldwin. In this episode, we learn what those present say happened on the day of the shooting and the fallout so far. This is Dark Poutine episode 311, Away Game, Reckless Rust, The Death of Helena Hutchins, Part 2. May Making a feature film, unless in exceptional cases, requires a lot of people power and has many moving parts. In addition to the cast, background performers, and many crew, a lot happens behind the scenes in the production office. The management team must coordinate every resource precisely to stick within budget to ensure the film is made. According to a report by the New Mexico Occupational Health and Safety Association, Ryan Smith was the producer in charge of the entire production. Gabrielle Pickle served as the line producer and management representative for Rust, with responsibilities that included hiring staff and crews, authorizing work hours, and possessing the power to advise or take disciplinary actions against workers across all departments. Reporting directly to her was Catherine Rowe Walters, the unit production manager who held similar powers. Dave Halls, first assistant director and safety coordinator, managed the set and oversaw general safety. He was considered an authority equal to Gabrielle Pickle and Roe Walters within the management team. In his dual role as actor and producer, Alec Baldwin and Joel Souza, the director, engaged in discussions with several producers to secure support and financing for the Rust project. Baldwin had the power on set to sanction alterations to the script and approve potential actors. According to an announcement from the New Mexico Film Commission, the filming of Rust began on October 6, 2021. Filming was to take place about 13 miles, 21 kilometers south of Santa Fe on the Bonanza Creek Ranch, where most of the production was completed. According to the ranch's website, Bonanza Creek Ranch has been a key player in New Mexico's film industry for over 70 years and stands as a top filming site in the western U.S., hosting everything from major independent films, TV shows, music videos, commercials, and photo shoots. The ranch offers a diverse array of scenic settings. Spread across thousands of acres in northern New Mexico's foothills, it features expansive views, a western town with 24-plus structures, a picturesque pond, significant rock formations, and deep, dry creek beds known as arroyos. Its isolated location enables flexible scheduling, while just minutes from Santa Fe offering convenient travel for productions.
I had no idea that a set area would be that big, thousands of acres. I just didn't picture it being that large.
Essentially, it's a town, okay. A little far west town ranch kind of thing out in the middle of the New Mexican desert.
But it's not a working town anymore.
I don't think it ever was. Okay. I think it was built specifically
for filming.
Right. Hmm. And I worked on a local site like this owned by former stuntman Danny Virtue just outside Maple Ridge while I was on several productions like Wicker Man. And it gives cast and crew and audience an authentic feel of being in an old West town. There's a saloon and there's a sheriff's jail and a schoolhouse and all that kind of stuff. It's
Your stuntman was Danny Virtue?
Danny Virtue, yes, that was his name.
Wouldn't Vice be a better name for a stuntman?
Danny Vice.
That sounds more stuntman-y to me.
It does, but Danny Virtue's kind of a fun name, too.
Was that a chosen name?
I don't know. I've only met him, I think, twice, and it was just briefly.
Imagine if that's your real last name and trying to live up to that.
Yeah, Virtue. As we mentioned in the last episode, several instances involving firearms on set concerned many of the more seasoned crew members during the filming up until the morning when Helena Hutchins lost her life. To recap, the crew's concerns were particularly regarding the inexperienced armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed. Typically, armorers maintain control of firearms between takes to ensure safety, but this protocol was frequently neglected on Rust. Actors and background performers were seen mishandling guns, lacking muzzle discipline, which requires always pointing firearms safely and not at others unless necessary under strict protocols. Hannah Gutierrez was criticized for her unprofessional handling of firearms herself, including taking a shotgun by the barrel with the muzzle pointed toward her face. Video evidence also showed Alec Baldwin mishandling firearms, including firing blanks unsafely and continuing to fire after cut was called, which violates set protocols. Baldwin's behavior, including urging quick reloading, contributed to a rushed and unsafe environment, according to some. The set experienced two accidental firearm discharges in one day, October 16th, an extremely rare occurrence that raised serious safety concerns. Crew complaints about these incidents suggested a lack of responsibility and called for the immediate replacement of the safety department, a suggestion ignored by production, which resulted in significant consequences, as we can see. The first incident involved Sarah Zachary, the props master, accidentally firing a blank round from a .45 caliber revolver. This occurred while she was attempting to safely lower the hammer, which inadvertently slipped, causing the firing pin to strike the primer and discharge the blank. The second misfire involved Alec Baldwin's stunt double with a lever-action rifle. The exact circumstances are unclear, with conflicting accounts about whether he was alone. The misfire reportedly occurred when the rifle was possibly handled too roughly, leading to its accidental discharge, as suggested by Hannah Gutierrez-Reed. Real firearms were seen unattended on the props cart for extended periods, and at one point a shotgun had become lost on set.
All of this is sounding so sloppy.
Yeah, it's like, it's okay if it's a rubber shotgun getting lost on set, but this is a real one that all you need to do is load a shell into, and you can do somebody in.
If you have toy guns that don't work, it doesn't matter, but...
Right.
You know, we have to keep guns locked up in our houses. They need to be managed. Like, I'm not anti-gun, but I'm anti-bad gun management, that's for sure.
Yep. A few members of the crew started referring to Rust as a shit show, film jargon for a terrible shoot due to many inexperienced crew members and perceived overzealous penny-pinching of production. In the days before October 21st, 2021, the camera department revolted. They were unhappy with several issues, and on the morning of the shooting, before things got moving for the day, a number of them quit, took their gear, and walked off set. So Lane Looper, the A camera operator on Rust up to that point, later shared his concerns with The Hollywood Reporter, explaining why he and his six co-workers quit. Several serious issues influenced the decision to walk off the Rust set. The shooting schedule for Rust was brutal, leading to a constant rush and significant work each day. The urgency meant insufficient time for camera rehearsals, safety meetings, or proper preparation. The negligent firearm discharges on October 16th, a concerning special effects explosion, poor weapon handling, inadequate housing leading to long commutes and insufficient rest, heavy physical demands, COVID-19 safety violations, and unresolved payment issues for the crew were also determining factors. Despite the union contract's requirement for timely payment post-show, the production team delayed and mishandled the process, offering incomplete personal checks without proper deductions or covering previous week's work, including meal penalties.
Well, first of all, you do not do that to unionized people.
No.
Or you're in for a whole heck of a lot of trouble.
You know, some people on the set said these guys were being prima donnas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or other not so nice words. But there are rules there for a reason.
There's rules there for a reason. And mm-hmm. At this point, I'm wondering how the heck Baldwin, who's a very experienced actor, who knows how productions are run. He's been doing it all of his life.
Mm-hmm. He's been producing too, yep.
Producing or participating and being on set. How mm-hmm. is he, because he was powerful in this. Like, he was a producer. He had power in this, right? He wasn't just some actor.
Right.
How is he allowing such a crap show to happen?
I don't know. That's a really good question. You can hear him yelling, hurry, hurry, hurry. And that puts a lot of pressure on people. Like, that's really the AD's job to yell that, if you need to hurry. But having a star like Alec Baldwin yelling that puts an extra level of pressure on the people on that set. Why would he do that? Was this something that he had such a big personal stake in that he was afraid that
Shitty Western.
It might be good. I mean, Joel Souza is not a bad director. He's a good director. And he's a good writer as well, so it might be a decent film.
Okay.
Like, low budget doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be crappy.
True. Some of my favorite films were made for next to nothing.
Look at Evil Dead, for example, Sam Raimi's first film. That's fantastic.
Look at any Fassbender film.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It relies on acting and beautiful, simple, beautiful shots, and that's it, right?
Mm-hmm. In the interview, Looper indicated that working with armorer Hannah Gutierrez-Reed was challenging because she was overworked and inexperienced. This was only her second show as a lead armorer, and she managed a small, inexperienced team in a prop-heavy, firearm-intensive Western. The urgency and pressure to expedite work further compounded these issues, highlighting a systemic lack of preparedness and safety on set. On the morning of Helena Hutchins' tragic shooting, the camera crew arrived at 6:30 a.m. crew call to retrieve their personal gear from the camera truck, separating their belongings from the show's equipment. During this process, Gabriel Pickle approached them, demanding they leave immediately and threatening to call security. After a heartfelt conversation and a farewell with Helena Hutchins, who felt like she was losing close friends, the crew completed packing and left the site around 7:30 a.m. They had breakfast together before parting ways. By no means were the camera department the only ones who were feeling frustrated with what was happening on that set. They just happened to be the ones who took action. From the outset, labor unrest had been occurring on the Rust set. While still in show prep, union members with the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, IATSE, on the production voted overwhelmingly for strike authorization due to concerns over working conditions and pay, but the strike didn't materialize. Helena Hutchins publicly supported the union's stance on her Instagram account. After most of her crew departed, Helena and production scrambled to hire a new camera crew ASAP. They didn't want to lose an entire day of shooting. They knew they would not meet their shooting schedule, but felt they could salvage a few crucial shots. What they didn't get that day would have to be done on another. In an article on TheWrap.com, according to an anonymous insider, quote, a walkout by crew members from the below-the-line IATSE union would ordinarily trigger a shutdown of the entire production for 24 to 48 hours. Instead, producers chose to hire non-union replacements to continue the shoot, end quote. Just a side note, I've tried to avoid using the words shoot and shooting in these episodes to refer to filmmaking as much as possible. The reasons should be obvious. Hannah Gutierrez-Reed later told police that on the day of the incident, she verified that the dummy rounds were not live ammunition before handing the gun off to Dave Halls. However, due to the following events, it does not appear that this is true, unless someone inserted a live round into the firearm without her knowing. Throughout the day, Hannah handed the gun to Alec Baldwin and first AD David Halls several times. David Halls told police that as part of safety protocols, he typically checked the gun barrel for obstructions and to ensure rounds were dummies even when no blanks were called for. He described a process where Hannah opened the gun's hatch and spun the drum, and he would check the rounds. If he felt comfortable, he would call cold gun on set. However, when Hannah presented him with the firearm before the ill-fated rehearsal, he recalled seeing only three rounds and acknowledged that he should have inspected all of them, but did not. He also couldn't remember if Hannah spun the drum to show all chambers were safe. Due to the pandemonium following the camera crew's departure, 3 hours had elapsed before the Rust cast and crew could begin their day. Before the crew broke for lunch, they worked inside the wooden church on the ranch, the setting for a gunfight between Baldwin's wounded character and lawmen. Baldwin's character was seated in a church pew, playing possum, and secretly cross-drawing his 1880s replica Colt 45 six-shot revolver from his shoulder holster underneath his overcoat.
I have to stop you here.
Okay.
I didn't know any details of this story before we recorded yesterday, and as you're reading this, as I read this today, right?
Right.
And, you know, all I knew was, hey, there was an accident on set. Hutchins had died. Baldwin was involved. And the news said he had shot the gun, right?
Yep.
But at this point, all this stuff that you're reading right now, it just seems to me like this tragedy was a foregone conclusion from the beginning. Like, that this production was such a mess that almost inevitably this is going to happen.
Well, yeah, I mean,
Mike, you've been on productions. This is a mess. Come on.
I'm not right. saying it's not a mess. What I'm saying is, hindsight is 20/20. And yes, absolutely. If you look at all the elements that lead up to Helena Hutchins' shooting, Of course. That's why people are being held accountable. It was foreseeable.
Right.
It was absolutely foreseeable.
It's just such a shame.
It really is, especially, you know, she's a mom.
She's a mom. She was young. She was talented. She had career ahead of her. It's just such a waste.
The morning shots were a medium close-up, MCU. An MCU frames the subject from just above the head to just below the chest. Recordings of this rehearsal were made and later released to the public. Alec Baldwin can be seen drawing his firearm from his holster over and over, pointing it out of frame. Also in video released from that morning, while adjusting the camera to eliminate a shadow, Baldwin can be seen describing his actions for the upcoming scene, stating his intention to draw the gun and simulate firing it with the words, "So I guess I'm going to take this out, pull it, and go bang." At no time in the video of this rehearsal did Alec Baldwin appear to pull the trigger. Positioned just 2 feet away from the gun's muzzle was the camera crew, including Helena Hutchins. None of them had on any protective gear, such as noise-canceling headphones or safety glasses. It wasn't considered necessary that day, as there was to be no live fire, no blanks in the gun. According to Hannah Gutierrez, when the crew took their lunch break, the firearms were securely stored in a safe within the prop truck on set. The dummy ammunition was left unsecured on a cart on set, and some dummy ammo was stored inside the prop truck. After lunch, Sarah Zachary, the props master, retrieved the firearms from the safe and handed them to Hannah Gutierrez. Hannah highlighted that only a few individuals could access the safe's combination, her and Sarah. Dave Halls handed the firearm to Baldwin after lunch. Hannah Gutierrez went outside the church while the camera rehearsal took place. This was unusual. As mentioned, the armorer is typically on set when a real firearm is present, even if it's not loaded with blanks. And she said it was COVID protocols, and she felt like she was extraneous on set at the time and not needed. And there were supposed to be only dummies in the handgun. So the shot was to be an insert shot, an ECU, which stands for extreme close-up. And it was to show only Baldwin's hand slowly drawing his revolver from the shoulder holster. And that's it. You do not see the firearm being pulled out completely. You do not see anybody pointing a firearm at anybody at any point during that extreme close-up. So the ECU did not call for that, as it wouldn't be shown on camera.
So this happened for an ECU.
So here's the problem, because I'm an actor as well. Perhaps what Baldwin was doing was to maintain the flow of his...
Keep going.
He wanted to follow through.
Because then it would seem natural. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So that's just my speculation. My speculation in my my very limited time as an actor. Like I'm a trained actor, but I haven't really been paid very
but
much.
But it seems like a natural speculation. I have another question for you. Do you think that COVID rules lessened communication between people? I'm just throwing this in. COVID was a weird time.
It was, yeah.
And do you think there was like, do you think the
people were masked, so you couldn't really see what they were saying?
There may be fewer, there's, life was very, it was all weird then, right?
It was, yeah.
Right? It was, everyone's heads were in weird places during COVID. I know mine was, like, yeah. What the heck's happening to the world, right?
As six of her crew had left, Helena Hutchins was inside the church doing double duty as director of photography and acting as the A camera operator. The crew was also having trouble getting a signal to the monitors at Video Village. Video Village refers to a designated area on a film or television production set where directors, producers, and other key crew members can watch the live feed directly from the cameras during shooting. This setup typically includes monitors, playback equipment, and sometimes seating, allowing these decision makers to review shots in real time, make creative decisions, and communicate changes without disrupting the filming space. Video Village is crucial for maintaining a clear overview of the production's visual progress and ensuring the director's vision is accurately captured on camera. With Video Village unavailable, director Joel Souza felt it necessary to be on set with Helena to ensure the shot was what he was after before things progressed too far. Alec Baldwin was positioned in the church pew practicing his slow cross-draw. At Hannah Gutierrez's trial, Joel Souza testified about what he recalled happening that afternoon.
So I went inside again to try to see what the angle was. There were a lot of voices. I heard Alec's voice. I heard Helena's voice. Everyone's sort of talking at once. I don't have a clear memory of how long I was standing behind her. I know I got up behind her to try to see on the monitor. And there was an incredibly loud bang that was not like the half and quarter loads you hear on a set. Those are sort of, they're loud poofs and pops. This was deafening. And it felt like somebody had taken a baseball bat to my shoulder. I remember that distinctly, and sort of stumbling back and shouting. I don't remember exactly what I said.
Were you able to see Ms. Hutchins at that time?
I did. I remember sort of stumbling back, and I either fell to my knees or I was sitting, and I distinctly remember her being lowered to the ground. People had her sort of by either side, and I still didn't quite know what had happened. Nothing made sense. I remember initially thinking, had she been startled by it, and they were sitting her down as a result, and then I saw the blood on her back.
And to the best of your recollection, what happened after that?
It got very chaotic. I remember them laying me down. I remember them laying her down next to me. Although we were sort of facing in opposite directions, my head was this way, her head was that way. I remember a lot of panic. I still just couldn't figure out what had happened. I thought, was there something that had been stuck in the barrel that came out? But just nothing made sense. I remember our dolly grip, Ross, coming to sort of grab me and trying to call me, and then Matt Hemmer came in. And between the two of them, I remember they sort of tended to me and were pulling up and just trying to find out where there was a hole.
Do you recall, Mr. Souza, at any point in time during that general time after the gun went off, having any kind of an interaction with Ms. Gutierrez?
I remember at one point looking up and her standing there with another person or a few other people. And she looked distraught. And I remember her saying, I'm sorry, Joel. And I remember somebody just screaming at her, and they just ushered her out.
Okay. At some point in time, were you taken from the scene?
You know, it's funny, when I hear later about how long we laid there, it felt like 5 minutes. And I remember, looking over and her looking back at me. And she had the biggest brown eyes I've ever seen. I don't remember who they took out first. They put me on some kind of stretcher and rolled me out.
After the break, we'll learn more about the immediate aftermath of the shooting and what's happened in the 2.5 years since. And we are back. Matthew, thoughts so far here at the halfway point?
it's, you know, yes, nobody wanted this to happen. It wasn't intentional, but somebody, people have to be held accountable because this accident happened as a result of flagrant rule breaking, right? And it totally could have been prevented. And I think that in a way, except for the smart people who walked out, like Lane Looper and the six others,
you
know, some people might have called them prima donnas, but they were proven right, right?
Well, here's the thing. Lane Looper would have been the A camera operator at the time, which was the job that Helena Hutchins was doing when she was shot.
Oh, geez, Louise. Yeah, so look at that, you know, call them prima donnas or whatever, but, you know, you have to kind of give them a pat on the back going, you guys saw some mess that you didn't want to be involved in. And like, other than them, I think, and this might be harsh, but I'm going to say it. It's everyone on that set has some level of responsibility for this, perhaps not legal responsibility, but they failed in an ethical responsibility to call stuff out, to quit, to stop things. Right. Yeah.
Some people did call things out. We don't want to say that everybody everybody did not.
No, I don't want to say that either. But I'm just it's there is a lot of opportunity for people to really stand up. Right.
I agree.
And I can tell you, anyone on that set in a future shoot or filming, sorry, I know it's
weird. See, that's a tough word,
because I use the word shoot all the time, right? Like, we did a shoot last week.
Yep.
All of those people are going to be very aware in the future now. I would think, right?
Yep, for sure.
And it doesn't make them, nobody's evil in this.
Nobody's
evil, right? It's some people were stupid, some people didn't speak up enough. It's a mess. And you know, obviously, I feel for the people that I got, the person that got injured and the person that got killed, but I kind of feel for everyone who's on that bloody set. Right?
Yeah, me too. I watched the entire trial. I watched all of the testimony. I watched all of the evidence that was presented. I just was obsessed with it because I'd worked, you know, I've worked on many film sets. So anyway, we'll get into more of that later. At first, as Joel Souza indicated, it was not clear what had happened. Crew members recounted the moments after the incident in an LA Times article. "What the fuck was that? That burns," Souza exclaimed in pain. Baldwin placed the firearm on a church pew, staring in shock at his two wounded co-workers, saying over and over, "What the fuck just happened?" "Medic," someone shouted as crew members gathered around Hutchins, attempting to stop the blood flow. A boom operator peered into her eyes. "Oh, that was bad," the sound technician remarked. "No," Hutchins responded. "That was bad. Really bad." At some point, Helena said, "I can't feel my legs." Crew members helped Helena, who was still standing at that point, onto a pew. When it became clear she was severely injured, she was helped to the floor onto her back so the set medic, Sherilyn Schaefer, could work to stem the flow of blood. Schaefer's kit was not prepared for a victim of a bullet wound, let alone two. There should be no need for it. But that day, of course, it was different.
First of all, I'm such a wuss. Like, just hearing all of that, I can't feel my legs and everything is upsetting.
Yeah.
But a question for you, Mike. If you have guns on set, wouldn't you have equipment for a bullet wound if
no.
you were a medic? Why?
Not up to this point. And here's why. There should never be a live round anywhere near a film set. That is just end of story, full stop. No live rounds on a film set anywhere. Even if they're if you've got one in your pocket because you were shooting like last weekend, you shouldn't have it. Mm-hmm. You should not have it at the film set because it's unsafe if there's firearms around.
Yeah, right.
I would hazard to guess that maybe there's going to be new safety rules after this occurs, because something that has gone on like this, you kind of have to now prepare for it every single time that you have a firearm on set. So some way, someday, maybe it will happen again, and somehow a live round will make its way onto a film set and somebody else will be shot. And perhaps now, because of what's occurred, there will be preparation for that by way of the set medic.
I was just thinking, like, you said it earlier, and I never even considered that. How, it's sort of like what was that movie series where a guy he gets off the airplane because he envisions the airplane crashing?
Final Destination.
Mm-hmm. Like, imagine you're at the shooting range, right? And you have bullets in your pocket, and you go to the movie set, one drops out, you know, near the props place. They pick it up thinking it's one of the ones sticking
in. One of
the
dummies,
like,
yep.
Stuff like that can happen. It does. It's very Final Destination, but that crap happens, right?
Yes.
And this whole situation feels a little bit Final Destination to me.
It really does.
Right? Yeah. In terms of all the little things that happened or could have happened, and we don't know yet. You're going to go into some more, and we still don't know, but all the things that could have happened where suddenly there was a real bullet in there.
Yep. Helena had an entrance wound in the chest, and the projectile had traveled through her body and exited her back. From there, it smashed into Joel Souza's shoulder. At 1:49 p.m., Mamie Mitchell, the script supervisor, called 911, summoning help, as did a few others. In her call, she can be heard saying Dave Halls, the AD, had yelled at her about script changes at lunch. She also said he was responsible for checking the firearms on set. ADs who are responsible for the pace of shooting can be notorious for their grumpiness. Some are type A personalities whose reputations among crew members can be poor. This kind of personality can be an asset for low-budget productions wanting to ensure they make their shooting days every day. Perhaps that's why I wasn't a good fit. For lack of a better term, I'm not anal enough. I like the creative side of things rather than the administrative.
I don't know if the listeners, I think because the show is, I do this with you, with a friend for fun.
Yes.
I don't think it comes across. I can be very type A in my business dealings.
Sure.
And I'd probably be a good.
I think you would too. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like I get crap done, you know?
Yep. I think you'd be good at it too. For me, not so much.
Maybe I missed a calling, Mick.
Maybe. I don't know. I can remember some...
Sliding doors, man, right?
Yeah. I can remember some nicknames that people had for certain ADs that were just not nice. And
Give me them.
No, I can't, because it would identify them.
Okay.
To people who are in the industry here. Okay. So... But, yeah, it's...
You can tell me later.
I will.
Stay tuned for the after show. And Ed Bossum, Elliot Attenberg, and everyone called him Yelly at Threatenberg.
Exactly. When it came to Dave Halls as an AD, he had a reputation before the Rust incident. An LA Times article reported that Halls had been criticized before for his safety practices on film sets. In 2019, he was fired from Freedom's Path after a prop gun accident, but replaced another AD on another film, The Pale Door, amid safety concerns there. Halls reportedly skipped a safety meeting on the one-way set before a dangerous stunt. This led to concerns from crew members about the inadequate safety measures and communication highlighted by a near miss between vehicles during a rainstorm. This incident led to a halt in production to address safety issues. In other reports, some people praised Dave Halls for his management skills, but still others criticized his approach to safety on set, with one colleague referring to him as, quote, safety last. A Rust crew member highlighted Halls' failure to conduct necessary weapon inspections and his casual attitude towards safety checks. These concerns are consistent with reports from other former co-workers and observations that safety meetings were often skipped on the set of Rust. The underlying issue is that assistant directors, ADs, who are responsible for safety, may hesitate to voice concerns due to their dependence on producers, fearing job loss if they challenge production practices too vigorously. This situation creates a dilemma where ADs might prioritize production flow over strict safety adherence. First responders arrived at the Bonanza Ranch at 545 Bonanza Creek Road and tended to the wounded. Joel Souza was taken to Christus St. Vincent Regional Medical Center in Santa Fe by ambulance, and Helena Hutchins was flown by Life Flight helicopter to the University of New Mexico Hospital in Albuquerque, where, after much medical intervention aimed to save her life, she was pronounced dead there at 3:37 p.m. Meanwhile, the investigation began. Santa Fe sheriffs had the unenviable task of deciphering what had happened. Rather than ensure the firearm was untampered with, inexplicably, soon after the incident, First AD Dave Halls grabbed the gun from the pew beside Alec Baldwin. He left the church to seek out the armorer, Hannah Gutierrez. Crew members reported seeing them together and checking the firearm near the props cart just outside. Mamie, the script supervisor, later spoke with Dave Halls, who was visibly upset, and he mentioned checking the gun's chamber and finding one round that looked, quote, different from the others, which were marked.
Oh my God, does that mean there were more real bullets in the gun?
No, it was just that one. It was just that one that was different from the others.
Oh, I see. The one that was, okay.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's scary.
Yeah, and he later said, I didn't get her to show me all the rounds, and I really felt for Dave Halls when he was testifying.
Well, imagine anyone on that, that woulda, shoulda, coulda, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the sleepless nights, and the why didn't I, and I should have, and I could have, and yeah.
On finding out what had occurred, Hannah Gutierrez, understandably, had a panic attack. At some point, she handed the gun to police. She was walked toward a police car and spoke on the way. Here's some audio captured by body camera.
Welcome to the worst day of my life. I can't believe Alec Baldwin was holding the gun. That's so fucked. Can't believe it. Oh, fuck.
You could hear the life flight helicopter in the background. Hannah, clearly in shock, gave her information to a sheriff's deputy.
Okay, what is your full name?
Hannah. H-A-N-N-A-H. Gutierrez.
How do you spell your last name?
G-U-T-I-E-R-R-E-Z.
What was that again?
G-U-T-I-E-R-R-E-Z.
What's your place of employment?
Here.
Here? What's the name of the...
Rust.
Is it like a video production or?
Yeah, it's Rust Productions LLC. Yeah.
What's your job there with them?
I'm the armorer. Or at least I was.
Later, after a bathroom break, Hannah expressed that she wanted privacy to avoid the reactions of some of the distraught, angry, and traumatized crew members. She said her career was over. Hear some more audio.
I just kind of wish that any of my coworkers could stop seeing me because I already feel super bad.
Okay, yeah.
I just want to get the fuck out of here and never show my face in this industry ever again.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Oh, I would. I'm like the only female armorer in the game and I just fucked up my whole entire career.
Where's the concern for Helena Hutchins? Just a question. In more body cam video recorded by police after the incident, Alec Baldwin was visibly upset, pale, and understandably in shock. Footage showed a visibly shaken Alec Baldwin, still in his cowboy attire, speaking to a police officer shortly after the incident. When asked if he was okay, Baldwin responded, "No, I'm not, actually." He acknowledged holding the gun during the event and cooperated with law enforcement, noting, "My hands are shaking." Baldwin has stated from the beginning that he did not pull the trigger and has no idea how the gun went off. In an interview later that day at Santa Fe Sheriff's Office, Alec Baldwin was told by detectives that Helena Hutchins did not make it. He exclaimed, "No," and covered his mouth, sitting in stunned silence for some time, unable to respond. According to the post-mortem examination report of Helena Hutchins, an autopsy and CT scan revealed that a gunshot had caused significant internal damage, including a collapsed right lung and bleeding in the chest after entering through the right side near the armpit and exiting through the left back. The bullet passed through the right lung and spine, indicating a shot fired from a distance downward and from right to left. Despite no evidence of intentional harm, the death was ruled an accident caused by a gunshot wound. After the incident, initial news reports made Dave Halls the fall guy. But as investigators dug more deeply, it became clear there were others to blame in the tragic chain of events that killed Helena Hutchins. The fallout after Helena's death has been massive. Too much to cover in detail without a huge multi-part podcast dedicated to this topic. So this is essentially, for lack of a better word, just a drive-by of this. I mean, even though we did two...
Bad term.
I know. Even though we just did two episodes, it is huge. This is massive. So a month after the incident, Mamie Mitchell, the script supervisor for Rust, filed a lawsuit against Alec Baldwin, accusing him of recklessness. Other suits have been filed by a crew who were present in the church, including Dolly Grip, Ross Adiago. Pretty much everybody is suing everybody else. Baldwin, however, in his first interview, denied pulling the trigger or knowing how live ammunition appeared on set and doubted ever facing charges.
I don't think that he would have thought there were live ammunitions on set, but I find it really dodgy that he's denying pulling the trigger.
Especially what we learn later.
And can I ask you a question, Mike?
Sure.
Mamie Mitchell, script supervisor, so she didn't get hurt, so why would she do a lawsuit against Baldwin?
Well, this is the thing. People are fearful about going back to a movie set. They've lost their livelihoods.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so they have PTSD.
Okay.
And it's more than just her. I just use her as the example of the first person to file.
Okay.
But there were others.
Okay, Ross, that makes sense. That makes sense. Like they're traumatized from this.
Absolutely, they're traumatized.
Okay, okay.
Alina Hutchins' family filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Baldwin and others for cost-cutting and reckless behavior. Rust Movie Productions LLC was fined by New Mexico authorities for safety failures. A settlement in the wrongful death lawsuit was reached, with Matthew Hutchins becoming executive producer as filming was set to resume. For clarification, an executive producer typically shares in any profit made from a film project. Hannah Gutierrez pointed the finger at PDQ Props and its owner Seth Kenny when she sued over claims that they provided her with mixed live and dummy ammunition for the production. That suit was later dismissed for lack of evidence. Santa Fe County investigators forwarded their findings to the DA, who would decide on charges. Baldwin sued crew members for negligence. Prosecutors announced Baldwin and Gutierrez would face involuntary manslaughter charges, with Halls agreeing to his plea deal for negligent weapon use. Charges against Baldwin were challenged for legal accuracy regarding gun enhancement laws, leading the DA to drop such charges but to maintain the manslaughter charges. Hannah Gutierrez was tried first over February and March of 2024. The core of the prosecution's case centered on Gutierrez Reed's alleged failures to uphold essential safety protocols concerning firearms on set. The prosecution argued that her negligence was not an isolated incident, but part of a pattern of disregard for established safety measures. They cited evidence indicating that live ammunition was present on set days before the fatal shooting, suggesting a systemic failure to conduct thorough safety checks. There were 3 hours of downtime on the morning of the shooting. Why didn't they happen then? The point is critical, as it establishes a timeline of negligence that directly contradicted the defense's portrayal of the incident as an unforeseeable accident. Seth Kenny of PDQ Props testified he supplied Rust with dummy rounds recently used on the TV show 1883, polished and checked to ensure they were not live ammunition. Dummy rounds are distinguished from live ammunition by specific features in the film and firearm safety industries. These include visual modifications like drilled holes or bright color markings, and lighter weight due to the absence of gunpowder and a primer. Dummy rounds may produce a rattling sound from a small object inside, typically a BB, signaling their inert status. Additionally, alterations to the primer and using non-standard materials for the bullet, such as rubber or transparent plastic casings, help identify them as non-lethal. Some dummy rounds also feature manufacturer branding as an extra identifier. Despite these differences, all rounds should be handled with safety protocols, treating every firearm as if loaded with live ammunition. Seth Kenny emphasized never sending out a dummy round that doesn't rattle. Kenny also mentioned acrimonious interactions with Gutierrez, including a text scolding her for losing dummy rounds and using dummy rounds from her previous movie, The Old Way, supplied by her father. Their last conversation before the shooting involved a dispute over an accidental discharge, the one on October 16th, after which Kenny chose not to engage further due to Hannah's emotional response. It was noted that Kenny's company also provided live ammunition for 1883 training, which he returned to his office, but did not meticulously inventory.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So the same company is dealing with live ammunition as well.
Right. But there is zero proof, and it has been investigated very heavily.
Yeah.
That there is zero proof that it came from Seth Kenny.
Yeah, but what you're just doing is showing all of the angles of who the heck knows.
Right.
Who the heck knows? Because I think we're still at that point, and I don't think anyone will really ever really know
that particular. Yeah. How on earth did six live rounds end up on this bloody thing? In her closing argument, the special prosecutor on the case, Carrie Morrissey, addressed the broader context of the incident, including the production's overall approach to safety and the specific actions taken by Hannah Gutierrez in the aftermath of the shooting. Morrissey pointed to Hannah's immediate concern for her career rather than the well-being of her colleagues as indicative of her overall attitude toward her professional responsibilities. This point underscored the argument that her negligence was not merely a lapse in judgment, but a manifestation of a more profound disregard for the critical importance of safety in her role.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, but I find so many paradoxes here, right? Mm. So paradoxically, if, you know, people might feel pressure to go fast, skip safety for budget or time, in that if they didn't do that, they might not get another job with this team in the future.
Right.
Not that I'd necessarily want to work with this team in the future.
Right.
But had she had a high level of safety standards and really proved herself to be a firm, trustworthy hand, that could have made for a much longer career, right? With the right people.
Right.
And then oddly, and this will sound weird, but you know the person I'd hire right now if I was doing a Hollywood movie to be that person would probably be her, because she's just gone through hell and she sees the consequences of it, and right. She would not let this happen again. It would be my guess, right?
My guess is she may not ever return to being an armorer in the film business or in the film business in any way.
Probably not, but I'm also a believer in, this is somebody died in this instance, right?
She is doing jail time right now.
But in terms of business, sometimes if a mistake is made and somebody learns, they're actually the best person to have on the next similar project because mm-hmm. they've gone through it, right? But when somebody's has died and this much publicity, then she's probably going to have to be studying for a new career after she gets out of jail.
Yeah. Prosecutor Carrie Morrissey methodically and masterfully dismantled the various defense arguments aimed at deflecting responsibility from Hannah Gutierrez toward production, Dave Halls, Seth Kenny, and Alec Baldwin. She challenged the suggestion that other individuals or factors such as production pressures or Baldwin's behavior were to blame for the tragedy. Sure, they played a part, but that wasn't what the trial was about. Instead, Morrissey focused on Hannah Gutierrez-Reed's exclusive responsibility for firearm safety, highlighting missed opportunities to prevent the incident through proper ammunition checks and control measures. Why, Carrie Morrissey asked, had Hannah not taken that morning's downtime to check the rounds she loaded into the firearm later handed to Alec Baldwin? This emphasized that safety on set was her primary duty, and her failure to adhere to this responsibility had fatal consequences. The evidence presented at Hannah's trial was damning for her. She was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter. There had been another charge of evidence tampering related to a baggie that was alleged to be cocaine given to the set craft services worker back at her hotel after the incident. The jury found her not guilty of that charge as the prosecution failed to prove what the substance was. Hannah's defense team claimed it was protein powder. Hannah Gutierrez, 26, currently is still in custody and will be sentenced on April 15th, 2024. She faces up to 18 months in prison. I don't know if she'll do that whole thing, but she may. Many argue that her sentence should be more lenient because she was the least powerful person on the set involved in the incident. We'll see.
Isn't that sort of so typical, though, that it's usually the least powerful people who take the fall in life?
Mm-hmm. What came out at Hannah's trial did not look good for Alec Baldwin either. He's set to face his own involuntary manslaughter charges for his role in the shooting this July. As we mentioned, there were several video clips played alleging Alec Baldwin's recklessness with firearms on the film set. Especially concerning for Alec Baldwin was testimony from an FBI firearms analyst who, when questioned by Kerry Morrissey, stated that the testing indicated that the Colt revolver used in the shooting would not have fired without pulling the trigger. In fact, during testing, the analyst had to break the revolver, bashing the pistol's hammer with a mallet to get it to fire without a trigger pull. Has Alec Baldwin been telling the truth? That'll be determined, legally at least, at his trial. Perhaps the question will never be answered. Where on earth did the live rounds on the Rust set come from? Investigators found 6 live ammunition rounds in various locations on set, including inside a box, on a bandolier, within a gun belt, and other spots. One of those other spots was with actor Jansen Echols.
Wow.
That poor guy, no wonder he didn't want to return. Anyway, Hannah Gutierrez denies it was her who brought the live rounds onto the set, as does her father, Thel Reed, and Seth Kenny of PDQ Props. So nobody's owned up to, and maybe they don't even know. Maybe they don't know that they brought live rounds.
It's probably the case, but 6 bullets all willy-nilly all over the place.
Yep.
And in somebody else's gun. Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's just incredible, Mike. That's incredible. Oh my God. I can't believe that.
Yeah. There's been lots of speculation about where these live rounds came from, and some of which is downright scary. There are many details we can't get into and rabbit holes we can't afford to go down too far. One includes prop master Sarah Zachary throwing away dummy ammunition after the incident, which she claims was a reactive decision. There was one unproven rumor published by The Wrap only days after the incident that is particularly concerning. They wrote that on the morning of the incident, quote, a number of crew members had taken prop guns from the New Mexico set of the Indy Western, including the gun that killed Hutchins, to go plinking, a hobby in which people shoot at beer cans with live ammunition to pass the time, the insider said, end quote. Again, this is unproven, but the suggestion of it is disturbing. This is likely a vicious rumor, as the prosecution proved the live rounds to have been on set for days before the incident. But again, how did they get there? Unless new evidence comes out at Alec Baldwin's trial, we will likely never know. And Baldwin is trying to get those charges thrown out, so the trial might not even happen. Although the production was suspended after Helena Hutchins' death, filming for Rust was completed in 2023, and they lost their first distributor. Filming resumed with a new director of photography, Bianca Klein. The script, especially around the deadly scene, was changed. Significant cast changes also occurred, including actor Jensen Ackles' departure from the project. New distributors were found, and a release date is pending. The film has already won an award, but it was a notorious one. In 2022, the Alliance of Women Film Journalists awarded Rust an EDA Special Mention Award in the Hall of Shame category. This was due to the failure of its producers, crew, and cast to adhere to appropriate safety measures, which led to the unfortunate death of Helena Hutchins. An article in the January 2022 issue of American Cinematographer paid tribute to Helena. As she was named one of American Cinematographer's rising stars of 2019, she was to be featured in an interview. Helena Hutchins found herself struggling to prepare amidst her busy schedule. Quote, I had hoped to prepare for this interview, she expressed in November 2018, but my attention was constantly diverted by ongoing projects and future plans, end quote. Despite her concerns about expressing herself in English, as it was not her first language, Hutchins communicated with clarity and passion about her craft, the cinematic narrative's power, and the value of teamwork with like-minded directors and crew. So by the time of her American cinematographer interview, Helena Hutchins had already made significant strides in her career, having worked on numerous shorts, a few feature films, and her acclaimed AFI thesis film, Hidden. She considered herself a continuous learner in her field, emphasizing the importance of evolving through each project. Reflecting on her journey, Hutchins humorously acknowledged her diverse experiences, stating, quote, I have a lot of life stories, and remained focused on elevating her work with each opportunity. Sadly, she'll never get the chance to share more with us. So when I was in LA, just so you know, I visited the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, and right very, very close to Chris Cornell, who was the lead singer of Soundgarden, was the grave of Helena Hutchins. It had like a little Ukrainian flag on it and a picture of her nearby.
Do you have to have been in the film industry to be buried in that cemetery?
No. And the inscription on her headstone is, her light shapes our lives. Keep chasing your vision.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was so sad. I mean, you know, and this is even before I really made the, I was thinking about doing this case. But it was kind of like, I didn't expect to see her there. I didn't expect to see her face. And so when I turned and I saw it, that is when I made the decision in my head that I'm going to do this case for sure.
Like, I like how she said, I have a lot of life stories.
Yeah.
That resonates with me because I feel like that as well. They're almost different lives, you know?
I say that to people all the time when I'm talking about telling stories. I say, I feel like I've lived 1,000 lifetimes.
Yeah.
I really do. I really, really do. And maybe, hopefully I'll live 1,000 more, and so will you, and everybody listening as well. And that's it for Dark Poutine, episode 311, Away Game, Reckless Rust, The Death of Helena Hutchins, part 2.
That's right, it's time for voicemails. You can leave us a message at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you. Let's see who called us this week.
Alrighty, let's listen to our first voicemail. Let's see who gave us a call this week.
Hi guys, this is Banafi, Cheryl. Just want to say thanks, Mike, for letting me take you around and putting up with me and my friend Haley. I'm trying to think, like, I think the neatest thing taking you to see was by accident was Houdini. And the one thing I actually dreaded / was kind of excited for was, the Los Feliz Murder Mansion, because, I wasn't sure what your reaction would be, but yeah, you guys come out, let me know. And, take you guys out to eat again and whatever. All right. Thanks. Bye.
That's what Banafi sounds like.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Hi, Banafi.
Yeah, she and Haley and little Eva took me around to all kinds of different places, and we had such a good time seeing Houdini's place. His estate was a surprise. We were just waiting at a stoplight and looked over, and it's like, oh, it's Houdini's estate.
It just appeared as if by magic.
Just poof, there's Houdini. And the Los Feliz murder mansion that she's talking about is really strange. Like, she and her friend had very strange reactions, saying that they felt like they had headaches after they had seen it one time, which is odd because the perpetrator of the murders killed people with a hammer by hitting them on the head.
Ouch.
So what, I didn't know anything about this place. And we're driving away, and I said, my throat feels really tight. And they're like, really? And I'm like, yeah, it feels really tight. And then I don't know why I asked. I said, what did he die of? And they said, well, he poisoned him. He tried to poison himself. And it was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. So I had some weird reaction. I don't know, some... Yeah, it was just strange. It was very strange.
My throat feels really tight after every time I go by George Michael's house.
Why? I went by his grave when I was at in the Highgate Cemetery.
He was such a good songwriter. Oh,
he was. Yeah, he was.
Praying for Time. Have you ever like paid attention to the lyrics?
I love his music. Ugh. I always loved his music. Anyway, so yes, thank you, Cheryl, for calling in. Much appreciated. We were sort of pestering her to call, and she did. So you can call anytime.
She can call anytime.
Yeah. All right, let's listen to another.
Hey, Mike and Matthew. This is Mark from Vernon, BC. Just wanted to say that I truly appreciate and enjoy the podcast. I love your attention to detail, and I love your sincerity and the thought you put behind the people and the families in the story. I think that's awesome. I also wanted to say that the difference in energy since Matthew has come on board is fantastic. I love how you guys can joke around. I love how you guys gel together. I think it's what the podcast really needed. So, yeah, that's very cool. And with that, I'm out of here. Thank you guys for what you do, and see you on the next episode. Go take a shit in your hat.
Yeah, thank you so much.
He's from the sunny North Okanagan.
Yeah, there you go,
Vernon.
And much appreciated. Yeah, I like the energy you bring too, Matthew. I really do. I appreciate you so much, my friend.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I mean, there. Yeah, it's a strange old world. How things happen. I just said, hey, Matthew, would you like to do this with me someday? And you joked and said, yeah, sure.
And then how we met. I saw your sticker and on your phone, and I thought, and I said, do you own a poutinerie? That's how, when we first met. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
I saw Dark Poutine. I'm like, oh, do you own a poutinerie?
Well, I probably should have a poutinerie, but I do not. So,
oh, wouldn't that be great if we like actually opened up a Dark Poutine? It's a poutinerie cafe. It could be a gaming cafe poutine, and we could do like meetups there. That'd be awesome.
That would be amazing.
Not going to happen, but that would be awesome. Anyone like want to give us like $1 million? We can open up the Dark Poutinerie. That would be great. Thanks.
Yes, thanks.
Thanks.
I can't remember. Okay. Alrighty, we have another voicemail. One more.
Hey, Mike. This is Mason, a long-time listener from Kilbride, Newfoundland. I called earlier with an awkward voicemail because I got a bit nervous when the beep comes. So I called about the Greg Parsons case that it'd be cool if you guys could cover. I also have another case there I was hoping to maybe someone could do a podcast on. It's a bit of a cold case now. It's in St. John's, and it's involved in two well-known criminals to the police and to the St. John's area. And one was found murdered, and then shortly after, the other one was found murdered. But there was never, ever an arrest, and it'd be an interesting case to find out, too. Apparently, they're linked and stuff, but... Anyways, like I said, massive fan. It'd be nice to get on the show somehow by this voicemail. It'd be pretty badass. And by the way, the new Newfie accent's not the best. You got to keep working on it, Mike. You're almost there. Anyway, thanks, guys, and keep up the great work. Rock on.
My Newfie accent isn't great. I know that.
Thanks, Mason. You know, when I moved back here, like I kept on bumping into people from Newfoundland, and I always thought they were Irish.
Well, there is sort of a bit of the Irish lilt in
just
the Newfie accent.
Bit, you
yeah.
think?
Yeah. But, yeah. I think I've been away too long. I've been away too long, and I can't do the accent anymore.
You're losing your East Coastness.
Well, I'll never lose the...
Say Lord Tundra and Jesus for me.
By Lord Tundra and Jesus. Well, yeah, I'll never lose...
You didn't sound like Mason there.
No.
No.
No, but there's... It's like any region, there's also regional dialects and inflections that are different in mm-hmm. different places, too. So, and often when people hear their own accent, they don't think it's good because, you know, to themselves, to me, I don't think I have an accent at all. But we do.
Oh, after moving back from the UK and like my... My Southwestern Ontario accent just came raging back. My husband followed me 6 months later. He was like, oh my God, your accent has changed in 6 months.
You sound like
months.
A hick.
he jokingly goes, you are a provincial people, aren't you?
Yeah, we really are. But yes, thank you so much. And I would, yeah, like I'm interested in those cases too. Yeah, we'll have a look.
I'd like to do another Newfoundland one.
Yep, me too. Yeah, I've got some sort of on the back burner that I've been meaning to do, so we will look into that. That's it for this week's voicemails. Again, you can leave us one at 1-877-327-5786 or 1-877-DARK-PTN. We'd love to hear from you, even if it is just to say hi and to tell us to go shit in our hats. If you're stumped for what to chat with us about, a quick story is welcome. All right, so we have some patrons this week, and first up, we have from, it appears as though they might be from Australia because they're paying us to be patrons in Australian dollars.
Oh, that would be a good hint.
This person's name is Vicky Barrett.
Hello, Vicky.
Vicky Barrett. So where in Australia is Vicky, and what on earth does she do, Matthew?
She's from North South Wales.
Okay, North South Wales.
So when I first went to Australia, it's called New South Wales, but I misheard it once, and for a week I was calling it North South Wales.
Oh, yeah, because it's NSW, yes.
North South Wales.
Oh, boy.
And I think she has a macadamia nut farm outside of Byron Bay.
I would love to go to Australia. I have always dreamed of going there. There's a few places I've dreamt of going.
I've been a bunch of times, and it's lovely. Yes, so macadamia nut farm outside of Byron Bay.
I love me a good macadamia nut.
Yeah.
They're yummy. Next up, we have, let us look, Taylor Foster. And Taylor is from Victoria, British Columbia, the capital of our province. Well, thank you so much, Taylor. What do you think Taylor does over there, across the water?
Taylor is either newly wed or nearly dead.
Okay, that's typically the people who live in Victoria, yes?
I say newly wed.
Okay.
And... I think Taylor is actually a spy for Alberta in the BC legislature.
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
somebody's got to do it.
Do our provinces have separate spies for spying on the other provinces?
That would be really boring, but it would be a super boring job. But
or really fun. So, yeah. So she's a provincial spy for Alberta.
Fair enough.
Sorry, please don't negate your Patreon. No, either that or she works at I think she is a curator at the museum there as well.
The Royal Museum?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a very nice place.
Museum Royale.
Well, thank you so much. To our patrons and
Donut
Money donors,
we really
much appreciated.
Appreciate it.
Yes. Thanks to all our patrons and Donut Money donors, past and present, for your generosity. It helps to keep the show going. You can become a patron of Dark Poutine at patreon.com/darkpoutine. For a one-time donation, you can send us Donut Money via PayPal using our email address, darkpoutinepodcast@gmail.com. If you don't already subscribe to the show, it would mean a lot if you did. You can easily find Dark Poutine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. If you haven't gotten yours yet, my book, Murder, Madness, and Mayhem, is available to order via a link on the Dark Poutine website. And speaking of darkpoutine.com, please check it out for show notes and other cool stuff. We'd appreciate it if you took the time to give Dark Poutine a like or a follow on Facebook and Instagram. Most importantly, thank you for listening, and tell your friends about us. Word of mouth is a powerful thing. And that's it for this episode of Dark Poutine. So until next time, don't forget to be a good egg and not a bad apple.
Goodbye.
Bye.
I said to my parents, don't trust her, I wouldn't listen.
Every family has a secret.
Joy Delaney, mother of four, has gone missing.
From the author of Big Little Lies comes a chilling new mystery to W.
You are an emotional chaos sinkhole, Amy, and I'm sick of it!
Starring Annette Bening.
Nobody can break your heart like your own children.
And Sam Neill.
She will come back.
Here we go, strap in.
Apples never fall. All new Thursdays, only on W. Stream on Stack TV.